Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Kenya Monhe and Travis Forbes? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Kenya Monhe was born on January 26, 1992. She lived in Denver, Colorado. In 2011, Kenya was studying broadcasting at a local college. Travis Forbes was born on October 4, 1979, and lived in Denver. He accumulated an extensive criminal history throughout his life, including charges for burglary, assault, and harassment. Eventually, he started a sandwich and granola bar business, which he operated from a bakery on South Trenton Way in Denver. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On March 31, 2011, 19-year-old Kenya and two of her female friends went out for a night of partying. Kenya had fake identification, which she used to enter the 24K bar on Market Street just after 11 p.m. She became extremely intoxicated and disruptive. Kenya was kicked out of the bar by a bouncer at around 1 a.m., now on April 1, 2011. She was with a young man who was also escorted out. Kenya left her cell phone, purse, and car keys on a table in the bar. Later on April 1, Kenya's family members noticed that she was missing. The friends gave her property, including her cell phone, to her stepfather. He reported Kenya missing to the police at about 9:40 p.m. Here's what the police found during their investigation. The police tracked Kenya's movements after she was kicked out of the bar using video available from surveillance cameras in the area. They saw her enter an apartment building on 15th Street. She was with a young man. At about 1:15 a.m., she was seen coming out of the elevator on the fifth floor. As she was walking down the hallway behind the young man, it was clear that Kenya was intoxicated. A few minutes later, she returned to the elevator and exited the building. The police spoke to the young man. He said that Kenya was in his apartment for a few minutes and then left. His story was supported by the video. At 2:04 a.m., Kenya was captured on camera walking alone in a hotel about a block away. The police believed that she was there to use the restroom. Cameras did not capture her leaving the hotel, but she was no longer there. This appeared to be a dead end in the investigation, but fortunately, the police had another important lead. After Kenya's friends dropped off her phone at her residence, her stepfather examined it. He saw that she had received a text message at 6:56 p.m. The message read, quote, "Hey, this is Travis, the guy who gave you a ride last night, white creepy van. Did you get home okay?" Unquote. It didn't take long for the police to realize that the message came from Travis Forbes. They caught up with Travis and one of his friends on April 3 at a gas station. Travis and his friend said that they observed Kenya talking to a transient man in the area of 15th Street and California Street. This was at about 2 a.m. She appeared to be very intoxicated. Therefore, they offered to take her to Club Lavish, which is where she said her car was parked. The three individuals were unable to locate the vehicle. Therefore, Travis offered to take Kenya home in his white cargo van. He dropped his friend off and continued with Kenya in the van. So at this point, only Travis and Kenya were in his vehicle. When they were on Spear Boulevard, Kenya requested a cigarette. Travis pulled into a Conoco gas station, but it was closed. Kenya exited the van and approached a man on the street who was smoking. She asked him for a cigarette, and he gave her one. Travis said that the man went by the name Dan. Kenya and Dan talked in Spanish for a while as they smoked. When they were done smoking, Kenya and Dan walked off together. Travis asked Kenya if she was okay, but she did not respond. At this point, Travis drove to his girlfriend's house. The police looked at the inside of the white cargo van and noticed that it was exceptionally clean in the cargo area, but dirty in the front of the vehicle. The van smelled like bleach, and the carpet in the cargo area was new. On April 5, the police conducted a formal interview of Travis at Denver Police Headquarters. He repeated the same story. He gave Kenya a ride, they stopped, and she walked off with a guy named Dan. Travis went to his girlfriend's residence, arriving between 3 and 3:30 a.m. He left for work at about 8:30 a.m. His girlfriend's name was Carrie Humphrey. The police spoke to Carrie. She confirmed the alibi that Travis had supplied. Despite this alibi being corroborated, the police were still suspicious of Travis Forbes. The gas station Travis referred to was obviously closed at the time when Travis claimed to stop there looking for cigarettes. Like, the station was completely dark. Nobody would have pulled in there believing it could have been open. Also, the bakery where Travis worked had supplied surveillance video to the police. On April 1, cameras at that business captured Travis engaging in suspicious activity. For example, he was seen rolling a cooler into a freezer, carrying a roll of carpet from his van, and handling a bottle of bleach. Travis was spotted in an office wearing yellow gloves, and he disabled the camera system. On April 6, investigators examined data from Travis's cell phone and discovered that it was not anywhere near Carrie Humphrey's home on April 1 between 3 and 8 a.m. On April 26, the police spoke to Carrie again. She told them the same story. They told Carrie that they knew she was lying. She changed her story and said that Travis asked her to lie and say that he was at her home. She never asked him why he made this request, but Travis offered an explanation. He said that he was sleeping in his van and it would look bad for him not to have an alibi when a woman went missing in the area. Later, he said that he was on a marijuana run during the time when the victim disappeared.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. or wherever fine podcasts are found.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes, I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
The police were fairly confident that Travis was the killer. They arrested him on May 4 in Austin, Texas, on suspicion of auto theft. He was interviewed again and continued to deny any involvement in Kenya's death. Travis was released after the victim in the auto theft case refused to press charges. This turned out to be a catastrophic mistake. On July 5, 2011, Travis viciously attacked a woman named Lydia Tillman and set her apartment on fire. She survived, but was severely injured. She spent 5 weeks in a medically induced coma. Investigators found DNA on the victim and sent it to a lab to be analyzed. As they were waiting for the results, they were getting pretty nervous about what Travis was up to. On July 10, they stopped Travis as he was walking on a street and asked him questions. He told the police his name was Travis Kennedy. One could argue that Kennedy is probably not the best choice for an alias when suspected of killing a young woman, but this is what Travis selected. The police let Travis go, but then saw him following an intoxicated woman through a poorly lit neighborhood. They were concerned he was going to attack someone else if they didn't. Just before Travis was about to make bail, the DNA recovered in the Lydia Tillman case was matched to Travis. Travis was given an upgrade in his charges to attempted murder and arson. The police once again questioned him about the murder of Kenya Monhay. He told them that he would confess if he was given a deal. He did not want to face the death penalty. Travis was granted his wish. He told the police that on April 1, he picked up Kenya, drove her to a park, and strangled her. He showed the police where he buried Kenya's body under a cottonwood tree in Weld County, about 40 miles away from Denver. On September 26, 2011, Travis Forbes pleaded guilty to first-degree murder. Almost a month later, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts on a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number one, Travis Forbes was always looking for his next victim. He knew that he was a suspect in Kenya's murder, yet he attacked another woman, and he was seen following yet a third potential victim when he was arrested 5 days later. Travis appeared to have an obsession, which no number of compulsions could satisfy. No matter how many times he offended, he always wanted more. Item number two, Travis could have escaped responsibility for murdering Kenya. He carefully cleaned his van, destroyed other evidence, and disposed of Kenya's body in a place where the police would have probably never found it. They had searched extensively without success. Travis had managed to target a victim who was alone, intoxicated, and not carrying a cell phone. Kenya was in an extremely vulnerable position. The key mistake that Travis made was sending the text message to Kenya's phone after he killed her. It's almost like his anxiety pushed him into making a bad decision. He didn't know if anyone had seen him with Kenya or if surveillance cameras had captured them together. If he became a suspect, he knew the police could track his movements by looking at his cell phone data. Travis decided to be proactive and introduce himself into the investigation. He wanted to find out how much the police knew about his connection to Kenya. If Travis had simply done nothing, he probably never would have been arrested for the murder. If the police didn't know who he was, they could not have examined his cell phone data. When Travis placed himself with Kenya right before she went missing, he created a series of problems for himself, including with his alibi. This brings me to item number three. Travis convinced his girlfriend, Carrie Humphrey, to lie for him by supplying him an alibi. She did not know what Travis had been doing, but she still thought it was a good idea to lie to the police to protect him. Carrie pleaded guilty to attempt to influence a public servant, false reporting to authorities, and perjury in the second degree. She was sentenced to 60 days in jail, 2,000 hours of community service, and she must seek mental health counseling. Carrie talked to the media about her relationship with Travis. She said that they met through mutual friends. Travis came very highly recommended by all of them. There was an instant attraction. Travis had a tendency to draw people into conversations. He could find a way to relate to what you've been through. Carrie said that she felt understood, let her guard down, and trusted him. Travis was generous and displayed random acts of kindness. For example, one time when they were walking down the street in the snow, they passed an older woman who appeared to be down on her luck. Travis took off his scarf and gave it to her. Carrie thought to herself, wow, this guy seems like a very good guy. Item number four, Carrie wasn't the only one who was manipulated by Travis. He gave several interviews to the media. He would cry and demonstrate dramatic facial expressions consistent with sadness and regret. Many people were convinced that he was being genuine. The police spoke to several women that he dated who found him charming and harmless. Some of the women he dated, however, had a different opinion. They said that he transformed into a different person during sexual role-playing. The look on his face indicated he enjoyed inflicting pain. There is this sense that his sadism would take over, like he could not resist giving in to his desires. Item number 5, the owner of the bakery where Travis worked talked about her interactions with Travis. He told her several lies. The owner confronted Travis and he admitted that he lied. He said, "I need to have people think highly of me, have a high estimation of me. All my problems have stemmed from my wanting people to be proud of me." The owner also said that Travis had a violent temper. For example, he once sent her a text message containing obscenities because one of his employees did not bake muffins properly. Travis's mighty meltdown to miserably mishandled muffin making was not the only manifestation of his mounting and monumental mayhem. One time he went into a half-hour rage and punched his van after one of the coolers was stolen. He was probably thinking, "Oh great, what am I going to do with the bodies now?" Moving to the last item, number 6. What personality characteristics may have been at work in the case of Travis Forbes? This is just a theory, my opinion. Travis appeared to have several characteristics consistent with psychopathy, narcissism, and sadism. From factor 1 psychopathy, Travis was grandiose, a pathological liar, manipulative, and possessed superficial charm. From factor 2 psychopathy, he was sensation-seeking, impulsive, irresponsible, and demonstrated criminal versatility. As far as narcissism, Travis was selfish and had a sense of entitlement. His sadistic characteristics are evident with his sexual behavior. He wanted to inflict pain. He was probably on his way to being a sexual domination serial killer. What made Travis particularly dangerous was his style of manipulation. He was much more sophisticated than most aspiring serial killers. When interacting with people, he allowed them to talk. Travis appeared to be empathic. He was a good listener. He used his cognitive empathy, but did not have affective empathy. So he could understand how people felt, but he could not feel how other people felt. This is like trying to understand the texture of an object without physically touching it. He was trying to behave like someone who could feel what others feel without having those feelings himself. Another element that increased the danger potential with Travis was how his manipulation strategy did not involve putting people down or turning them against each other. Other people really believed that Travis was genuine and altruistic. Travis had a level of neuroticism low enough to be cold and calculating, but high enough to be impulsive, anxious, and angry. It was almost like he was designed to be a killing machine. He could win the trust of victims, attack them, and then be calm enough to destroy evidence. The problem for Travis was his anxiety. It was a double-edged sword. The anxiety probably helped him to appear more genuine, but it also led to self-incrimination.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th-century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th-century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.